You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we check in on how teenagers are coping during the pandemic with a pediatrician and author of a new handbook for raising teens in the 21st century. First, President Trump tweeted yesterday that he's recommending the General Services Administration and his own team go forward with initial steps in the transition process. He followed that up by saying he's not conceding the election and pointing out that the GSA doesn't determine an official winner. His tweets come after Emily Murphy, head of the GSA, sent a letter to President-elect Biden saying the agency would make resources available for his transition team to start their work. Kathleen Dolan is professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee. She's here to talk about what this all means. Kathy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, in a normal time, Kathy, I don't think the General Services Administration is a household word. Can you talk about its importance, its practical importance in a presidential transition?
Well, the practical importance of the GSA in all of this is that they control the money that comes from the federal government to the campaign of the president-elect so that that person and the campaign can start moving the transition elements forward, connecting people from the transition team to members of the government, starting to share information, office space, equipment, computers, all sorts of logistical things.
What did you make of the delay in this go-ahead from the GSA to start doing all that stuff?
Well, I think it was, simply one more piece of an extraordinary election year in which, as we have continued to see sort of norms and different accepted procedures violated, the head of the GSA, seems in her letter yesterday to have believed that as long as some of the state recounts were moving forward and until all of the states had certified their elections, that she didn't have the sort of power or the authority to open up the transition process. Her interpretation of that is different than has been the interpretation of the various heads of the GSA at different points in our history. And it's clear, I think, that it was, her delay was motivated from the same perspective as, the motivation of lots of Republicans to not visibly antagonize the president by acknowledging his defeat at the polls.
So we have this decision from the GSA. We have, as you mentioned, more states certifying the results, including Michigan and Pennsylvania. President Trump says he's okay now with the GSA step going forward, but he says he's not conceding. He's still contesting the results. Are you seeing any inklings from those around the president himself, that they're getting closer to accepting the election results?
Well, the president may not accept the election results, and, quite honestly, he doesn't have to. I mean, his conceding the election is not a legal action. There's nothing that he has to do to accept the election. The states are moving forward. Enough states have certified their election results now that President-elect Biden clearly has more than 270 electoral votes. So it is at some level irrelevant that Wisconsin is still being, recounted and that we don't certify until December 1st. Arizona will certify on Monday, and that'll be the second to the last of the battleground states that have been contested to certify. And so there have been a sufficient number of votes certified that President-elect Biden is indeed the president-elect. Different states will continue to certify, and then we'll move on to the process of the beginning of the Electoral College process with state electors voting on December 14th. And all of this happens regardless of whether President Trump ever admits or accepts or acknowledges or concedes the election.
And briefly, Kathy, as we wrap up, I know there were concerns from people, especially in national security fields and in pandemic-related fields, that if we don't have a smooth transition, this could be a serious matter with serious consequences for life or death. What are you watching for to make sure those kind of critical areas have a smooth transition?
So you did point to the two most central. Certainly as we have what looks like a positive hope and a positive trajectory on a vaccine for COVID-19, the Biden administration needs to be working now with the people who are trying to get in place some procedures for approval of the vaccines and ultimate distribution of the vaccines. And so we don't want a situation like that to have a kind of faulty handoff. The same with national security issues. Some observers have been worried that this sort of period of transition could always be a time when different systems in the country or the different speaking of voices might make us vulnerable to some conflict or some attack. And so I think for almost any administration, we want continuity, and we want sort of a smooth American government to be visible to the world, so that enemies don't try to take advantage of this.
Kathy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure, no problem.
Kathleen Dolan is professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee. She was with us to talk about the latest on the presidential transition. Now, over the course of the weekend, the Transportation Security Administration, TSA, reported around 3 million travelers went through airport security checkpoints. We haven't seen numbers like that since the spring and the early days of the pandemic starting to take hold in this country at that time. This comes as the CDC and other public health authorities are urging Americans to not travel for Thanksgiving. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your view on flying right now? Have you recently flown? If not, what would it take, if you're someone who travels by air ever, to get you back in the air? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Laura Albert is a professor of industrial and systems engineering at UW-Madison, where she researches modeling and problem solving around issues of homeland security, disasters, and public services. Laura, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What is your response, first of all, Laura, to these numbers we heard reported by the TSA from this past weekend of traveling? It's not going to be a normal Thanksgiving season, but a lot more people are flying than have been over the last few months.
Travel has definitely increased even this past week. Up until this weekend, there was only one day when the number of travelers going through checkpoints hit 1 million passengers, and that was in mid-October. Then things were just under a million for about the past month, and then this past weekend we saw an uptick with the holiday travel. Now, there's normally between 2 and 2.5 million travelers per day, so travel is down about 60% compared to where it was at this time last year.
Now, airlines, of course, are businesses. They need airfares to stay in business and keep their staff on site. But it's not, as the CDC is saying, this is not a great time to travel for health reasons. How do we balance the business interest and trying to stop the pandemic?
Sure. And that's tricky. The airlines have done a few things. And there's a lot of people that have to travel for a variety of reasons. And so it's good that we still have some flights going on. Airline travel is actually part of our critical infrastructure, so we want that part of our economy to be there in the long run. But you're right, we want fewer people to travel because that's an avenue for transmitting the virus, although the risk on airplanes is actually fairly low, and we can get into that. Mm-hmm. But really, it's the travel of people throughout the country that helps spread and seed the virus. It's really what they do when they get off the plane and maybe visit with others.
Can you talk about the on-plane experience, what we know about the safety when it comes to the coronavirus, and what airlines have tried to do to make it safer?
Yeah, we've learned so much these past few months, haven't we? And one of the big surprises is how infrequent the coronavirus is transmitted in transportation, both public transportation and on the airlines. You'd think there'd be a lot of super spreader events on the airplanes, but there really isn't. And what we've learned about how the virus gets transmitted, it's through particles in the air, the aerosols, as well as the large particles. One way to reduce the risk is to wear the masks, which is really effective with the large particles. And filtration is basically the solution to reducing the risk from aerosols. And airplanes have had great filtration for quite a long time. And some recent studies have suggested that it's really outstanding. It's basically the state-of-the-art air filtration is equivalent to something you see in an operating room. And all the air gets filtered every 3 minutes. And that makes a huge difference. There have been some risks on flights, spreading events that have been large, about 12 to 15 people. And they've been people that have been sitting very close to somebody with the coronavirus. And it's really just mostly been on the long haul flights, the 10 to 15 hour flights. So this is good news for travelers, although I think it's great if people stay home from traveling and follow the CDC guidance.
Now, how about airports, especially on holidays? I think of those long, say, security lines waiting to get in where you're standing next to the same bunch of people for many minutes, maybe half hour, maybe an hour if things are really going slowly. How big a concern is that?
I'm concerned. It's not negligible in the security checkpoints. I've studied aviation security a long time. Mm-hmm. One good piece of news is that the TSA made initial changes that were really meaningful. And with the low airport volume numbers, it allowed them to really implement things like social distancing, which would be hard if you had 2.5 million people coming through the checkpoint. So it gave the TSA agents a little bit of time to learn and master new procedures. There's a number of things they've done to reduce contact. Most of the risk isn't huge, but everything you can do to reduce the risk, these things layer on top of each other and actually make a meaningful difference. So one thing is the physical distancing in lines, which is hard to do when travel really returns because these airport lobbies weren't really built for our long security lines, and people tend to get crammed in them in these small areas when the travel will return. But right now, passengers can wait in physically distant lines. There's also some plastic shielding. Passengers generally handle their own tickets now and do some of the scanning to reduce physical contact with TSA agents. And there's a lot more disinfecting of the security checkpoints in various areas.
We're talking to Laura Albert, professor of industrial and systems engineering at UW-Madison. We're talking about airline travel, safety, and the pandemic. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about travel safety, airline safety during the coronavirus pandemic? Have you flown yourself? Are you thinking about it? Are you going to fly over the holidays? If you're avoiding flying and you're somebody who usually does do it for travel or business, what would it take to make you feel safe flying? And if you work in the industry for an airline and an airport, what are you seeing? What are you experiencing? Are you working much? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about air travel with Thanksgiving just around the corner. UW-Madison Professor of Industrial and Systems Engineering Laura Albert stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions about flying, about air travel during the pandemic. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Love to hear your thoughts, maybe your personal experiences. If you work in the industry, definitely like to hear from you. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Laura, we've talked about safety elements on the planes and airports, but you also referenced it maybe more about what we do when we get there, whether we travel by plane, train, or automobile. What are your concerns there?
Well, it's really, we know how the coronavirus gets spread. It's prolonged close contact indoors, typically. And a lot of times, especially when people are traveling during the holidays, it's to be with friends and family. And then you're looking at small groups or large groups of people in prolonged areas.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Larry is with us in Viroqua. Larry, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Larry?
I had. My daughter is going to be taking Amtrak from Seattle back to La Crosse next week, and I was wondering the safety of traveling by train. She is going to have a roomette, so she won't be in general seating.
Interesting. Train travel, Laura, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, on trains, you don't have the excellent filtration that you do on planes, but what we've been learning from public transportation, such as the subways, is that it's not as risky as you might think. In part, it's because maybe the door is open. There's a lot of mask usage now on these trains. And you're really looking at limited number of people you might be traveling with in a compartment and certainly in a room. That really cuts down on the major sources of risk. The key is to wear the masks, And a train is a prolonged amount of time to be spent with other passengers. And mask wearing is probably the number one thing to do.
Larry, thanks a lot for calling in. I wonder, Laura, I know whenever there's an airline crash, a disaster of any sort, the industry tries to learn lessons and apply them to the future. Are there things we've learned from past outbreaks, you know, the SARS and things like that of the past that have been useful in trying to react to COVID-19 when it comes to travel?
One thing that we learned is that, you know, it's reflexive that you might want to think about a travel ban, but they really have to be done very early on to make a difference. Otherwise, the virus will just spread and you're really only slowing it down, but not making a big difference. And that's counterintuitive, but it comes out of some of the math modeling work. So that's one thing that we've definitely learned from piecing things together. In some of these studies, they've looked at whether or not people actually got the virus on an airplane by doing some DNA studies and have verified maybe some transmission has occurred. So that's all some of what we're studying right now.
Let's go back to our callers now. Michael is on the line in Madison. Michael, hi.
Hello. I have a friend that's a TSA agent down in Florida, in Orlando. And one of the things that I know that the press does not cover is the infection rate amongst the TSA agents. And it's basically kind of like covered up because of the tourist industry down there. And I know that he had a big problem with fellow team members, TSA agents that were infected. There was a bunch of them that went to a birthday party. There was 14 that got infected. Then it turned to 21. Then it came to 42. I have no idea what the rate is now. And it was kind of like kept a secret because
Michael,
they felt that.
I gotcha, Michael. Thanks a lot for calling in. And Laura, yeah, I guess I've been focusing on the passengers so far. What do we know about protecting the TSA workers and the airline workers and other people?
It's really critical to protect the TSA agents in this. By early April, 706 TSA agents had tested positive and 5 died. As of today, 3,164 TSA agents have tested positive. There are 604 current infections and 10 have died. Right, so this is really sad. I will say that it is posted publicly on the TSA website. You can check the latest numbers, and they do post it by airport. So you can look at the infections at any airport throughout the country. And this is fairly transparent by the TSA. It is really concerning. You see some of the outbreaks mirror that of the general population, which suggests that the TSA agents are, as the caller suggested, generally getting the coronavirus outside of the workplace. But they together will work in these security checkpoint lanes in fairly close proximity over a shift. And if you're around somebody for an hour or two, even with wearing a mask, if it doesn't have the best ventilation, it's possible that they can transmit this to their coworkers at the security checkpoint. They're only around air travelers for just a few minutes, but with other employees, they're around each other for much longer. It's definitely a concern. And as a traveler, I really value what the TSA agents do, and keeping them safe is a high priority for me as I travel. And looking forward over at checkpoint security in the next 5 or 10 years, I'd like to see some major changes, less labor-intensive screening by the agents to increase physical distance, of course. And we can do that maybe through biometrics. Time will tell. We have to make sure the devices work really well. But I do think there will be some long-term changes as a result of these infections.
So, Laura, as somebody who is obviously studying this and following this really closely, is there something you're looking at in the COVID story as it relates to travel and wondering, you know, why aren't people paying more attention to this? Why isn't the media asking me about this? Is there something that's kind of nagging at you?
I'm looking forward. As an engineer, I'm always looking to solve problems and thinking about where we want to be in the future. And So there hasn't been a lot of discussion about things like TSA PreCheck. One way to increase physical distancing and to protect these employees is maybe to enroll people. But of course, nobody wants to enroll in TSA PreCheck if you're not planning to do any travel. So there are, I think, some big policy issues that have been nagging at me. And, you know, how do we think about solving these big problems strategically using analytics and industrial engineering, maybe to come up with some better policy that will put us in a better position in the long run?
Are we going to, you know, put in a lot of policies after this pandemic? And I don't know, and it might not leave us ready for the next one because it transmits a little differently or there's something unique about it that doesn't get covered. Do we overact? Do we overcompensate for the current crisis and miss the next one?
You know, I think a lot of viruses are transmitted through air, and some other things that we might do for the pandemic, like just reduce waiting times, is highly correlated with traveler satisfaction. So these are probably good things. They probably will just be really good in the long run. If we can find cost-effective ways to make travelers happy, this might cause them to return to travel earlier than they might otherwise.
And briefly, what are you watching for now as we enter what's usually peak travel season, I think?
You know, I know that travel will be up a little bit, but I hope it's not up by a lot when we see the final numbers, especially after Thanksgiving, because we might see a mirroring of that at Christmas time. That's something I'm definitely keeping an eye on.
Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure to be here.
Laura Albert is a professor of industrial and systems engineering at UW-Madison. We talked to her today about safety and security measures in the airline industry and how passengers, airlines, airports, the TSA are responding to the ongoing pandemic, especially with the holidays right here. Coming up, COVID-19 has made one difficult thing even more difficult for some, being or parenting a teenager. We talk with a pediatrician and teen health specialist for some practical advice. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the latest season of The Crown is just one of the cultural gems on this month's hit list. Get a timely guide about what to stream and play for the holidays. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, teenagers everywhere are undergoing a few more obstacles than usual over the last bunch of months. For one, many are stuck at home with their parents all day, every day. Being a teenager and parenting a teenager can be difficult even in normal times. And on top of all that, a growing number of families have the added wrinkle of growing up in the midst of a number of different cultures at once, as immigrants or military families or families with different religious, cultural, or ethnic backgrounds. Our next guest is a pediatrician who has a lot of advice to help parents and teenagers deal with some of the tough issues the 21st century can bring with or without a global pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you the parent of a teenager? Have you been in the past? Did you or your kids grow up in a global family one way or another? What are some of the biggest struggles or worries for your teen? And how has COVID shaken things up? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Love to hear from teenagers, actually. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Dr. Anisha Abraham is a pediatrician and adolescent health specialist. She treats and counsels young people with a variety of issues, including social media use, drug use, and stress. She's the author of the book Raising Global Teens, a practical handbook for parenting in the 21st century. Dr. Abraham, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
What is a global teen?
Well, a global teen is really a young person that's exposed to more than one culture in their daily life. And I wrote this book because I know that more and more young people are either moving from place to place, certainly from country to country or community to community. They may have parents that are immigrants. They are immigrants themselves. They may have parents, as you mentioned, from different backgrounds, or they may be exposed in their school or their daily environment to another culture. And it may not just be physical, but also virtually through social media or through the computer and through the internet. So a global teen is really, again, a young person that's had that exposure to more than one culture, which brings some wonderful things, but also can have some challenges.
Yeah, talk a little bit about some of the extra challenges that that can bring.
Well, what we do know is that if you have more than one culture, and I talk about my own experience growing up as the daughter of South Asian immigrants in Wilmington, Delaware, and the fact that it was a wonderful experience, but it wasn't until much later in life that I really could figure out who I could connect with most and who is my tribe and who I identified with. So certainly what young people do mention sometimes when they've had that cross-cultural experience is who is it that they feel most comfortable connecting with and really who is it that is their community. So that's one of the issues. Certainly if you're moving from place to place, and I've served as a military physician for a long period of time, and I can tell you that period of moving or transition or change can be really tough for young people. So one of the other issues that can occur is the issue related to grief and loss, leaving one community and having to rebuild yourself in yet another. And there certainly have been some thoughts also that when you are a cross-cultural teen, that this period of adolescence can be one that may be a little bit delayed because you're not having the normal kind of mirrors and anchors and the normal things that you would have in place if you only had one culture, if you were in a monocultural community. So there's a lot of things to be aware of when you do have a cross-cultural teen. But I certainly think there's also some wonderful strengths that we should be aware of too.
Yeah, talk about some of those positive sides of being a global teen through one of these many different roads you look at.
Yes, well, I also wrote this book because I'm the parent of two teenagers, and we had the wonderful opportunity to move from the United States and then live in Asia for several years, and then in Europe, and we've just recently returned back from living in Amsterdam, Netherlands. And I will say that some of the wonderful things that can happen when you have a young person that's had that experience of moving, much less, again, having parents from different backgrounds or having that exposure, can include things like adaptability and tolerance and a worldview. And these are certainly really important things to have right now, I believe. But on top of that, also things like having more than one language. And my own kids, for example, can speak several languages because they were exposed to these languages growing up. But also it's so much easier to pick up language when you're a young person than you are as an adult. So I think these are some of the important strengths that also come into place when you're a cross-cultural youth.
Talking to Dr. Anisha Abraham, pediatrician. Her new book is called Raising Global Teens, a practical handbook for parenting in the 21st century. And Dr. Abraham, I think a little secret of your book, so much of the advice as a parent of older teens myself is practical for, I think, any family. I want to start tapping into some of the advice you offer. I think one common theme that might generate conflict between teens and parents, global or otherwise, is, wait a minute, the standards that that my parents are applying to me are different than the ones of the kids in my school. And that might be because of different cultural backgrounds or whatever. What are some practical ways to navigate that kind of observation, that kind of problem?
You know, that can be a big issue. And there's so many different ways that can play out, whether that relates to alcohol use or it relates to sexual health. It relates to other norms that young people are trying to navigate as they're growing up. And I think it's very important for families to have conversations. And a lot of what I talk about in the book is the importance of creating and having conversations as a way to create connections with young people, but to also impart what your own values are as parents, and to certainly create those boundaries that and create those values that you think that are important for your teenager. Knowing that there are so many other values and so many other ways of perhaps also experiencing the world. So I think, again, coming back to conversations, talking about values, creating boundaries is an important way for parents to start to navigate this.
You share a lot of stories with Names Change, of course, of children you've worked with and their parents. One of my favorites is toward the end, a 16-year-old, I think, you worked with in Hong Kong, and you use her story to illustrate, you know, it's easy as parents and teens to focus on the problems. Here's the bad things that we need to fix. You use the story of a Queenie, I think is the name you used for her, to say, no, let's start with a positive thing. Can you share that with us?
Yes. I had a young patient in our clinic when I was working in Hong Kong at one of the public hospitals And she came in to see me because she was struggling with issues related to her weight, but also had been teased quite often in school. She had recently moved to that location, was having a lot of challenges in terms of how she was feeling about herself. And so when she came in to see me initially, she really wasn't looking me in the eye. She had her hair kind of in her face. And one of the things that we always talk about, and I certainly start with as a pediatrician, is about strengths and what is it that someone does well in, but also what their dreams are for the future. I think it's a really wonderful way to start a conversation with a young person. And when I talked to her about what her dream was and also what she thought she did well in, she said, you know, I like to draw and I want to be a fashion designer. And so I said, you know, let's keep talking about that and thinking about that. And then we continue to talk about her weight and her blood pressure and all of these issues. And the fabulous thing that happened over the time that I saw her is that each time she came back, we talked, of course, more about how she was developing those strengths. She was drawing. She started to get into drawing classes. She bought a sewing machine. She started to make fabric dresses and different designs. And as she started to build on that strength and started to think about what she thought was her own personal dream, she also started to lose weight and she started to look me in the eye and started to feel more confident about herself. And the very last time that we met, I mentioned in the book that she actually drew a picture of a design for me, a dress that she had designed for me as a parting gift. But I use that story as just an example of how much we as adults and caretakers and certainly health providers can do in terms of working with young people to build on their strengths and certainly then to build on their self-esteem.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Justina is with us in Egg Harbor. Justina, hello.
Hi there. Yeah, so we have a teen in the household who is struggling with it.
Oh, Justine, are you still there?
Well, not in person. We've been remote since April, and mm-hmm. So school board is just now starting to rationalize and put a plan together to go back. We're thinking maybe January. And we're also noticing, constant phone use. So I'm wondering about just tactical strategies.
And Justina, you cut out for a moment there. My producer said, I think the thing we lost was there's concern about anxiety or panic attacks.
Right. And then okay. I'm also wondering about phone use.
Gotcha. Justina, thanks a lot for the call. So worried about a teen with, and I'm sorry she cut out there, panic attacks during remote learning. And Justina, as we heard, concerned about phone use, social media use too, Dr. Abraham.
Yes. Well, Justina brings up some really important issues that young people are experiencing right now. And as she alluded to, the recent COVID pandemic is certainly making more young people feel isolated, feeling uncertain about the future, really not able to know how to perhaps get through things. And we are seeing more adults that are coming in with anxiety and depression, and certainly more young people as well. And the other issue that many parents report is that they're seeing more teenagers also using phones and other devices, probably much more than they've ever done. And so really, what's the best way to navigate it? And my short answer is, this is a really important time for us to really think about how we can support our teenagers related to mental health. It is a very difficult time for them. And so one of the things that I always go back to is, again, the importance of having conversations with young people about how they're feeling. And sometimes it's hard because they don't want to talk. They really are on their phone. They want to maybe be more with their peer group. But asking very specifically about how they're doing, and if they don't want to talk about themselves, my tip is to talk about what their friends are experiencing as a way to start to get them to talk about themselves. Are their friends feeling stressed or anxious? And then how are you doing? And I think Justina mentioned that her daughter was having some panic attacks. And so certainly, knowing that, talking about those things specifically, asking what might be triggering it, I think are really important. Also perhaps thinking about the fact that she may actually need some additional support. And in many cases, this is where I say that there's a broader global village that's out there to help young people if they are having these issues. Certainly you as a parent can be the first, reaching out to a coach or a mentor, but also there's a lot of wonderful health professionals that are available that perhaps can help address some of these issues. And a lot of them are also doing this through telemedicine. So it doesn't mean you always have to go in. But certainly, again, if there are significant concerns about anxiety, I would consider having Justina's daughter talk to someone just for some additional support in terms of how to navigate that issue. The other piece that I would, I would just also mention in terms of the phone use, what a lot of young people do tell me is that phones are a good way for them to connect with their friends. And I think there's a lot of value to it. But I will just mention very quickly that if a young person's only on their phone and not doing anything else, that may also be a sign that they need to have a little bit more balance. And so getting them to work on a little bit of non-digital time, a little break from phones, being able to do a little bit of, if possible, outdoor time or exercise or mindfulness or whatever those self-care things are that can help are also really useful right now.
We're talking to Dr. Anisha Abraham, pediatrician and adolescent health specialist. She's the author of the book, Raising Global Teens, a practical handbook for parenting in the 21st century. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a global teen? Were you one? Do you have one in your house? Growing up in the midst of a different culture, maybe in an immigrant community or somebody moved across the country, or maybe on around military bases over the years, a mixed religion, mixed culture family? Or do you have questions or thoughts to share on some of the difficult communication issues between parents and teenagers? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Dr. Anisha Abraham, pediatrician and adolescent health specialist. She's the author of the book, Raising Global Teens, a practical handbook for parenting in the 21st century. Still time for your call. If you call in now at 800-642-1234. Have you had the experience of growing up as a teenager in a different culture, maybe than was part of your family background? Or did you move around a lot, maybe in a military family? Or are you raising teens in that situation? Call 800-642-1234. And whatever your family experience is, what's going on during the pandemic? How are things going for you and your teen, or you and your parent if you're the teen? Call 800-642-1234. Dr. Abraham, and a few minutes ago, you talked about one way to open up communication about things like anxiety. You also offer some just general practical advice for better question asking from parent to kid to generate conversation. What kind of advice do you have?
Yes, I think it's a big question that parents always ask me is how do we improve communication with our kids. Sometimes it's really difficult to get them to open up or to talk about difficult topics, much less, you know, to ask certain questions. And as I mentioned to Justina, I think it's really important to start by asking about peer group. As I mentioned, again, if you can talk about what friends are doing, sometimes it's easier for teens to talk about what they are experiencing themselves. My other tip is to sometimes avoid talking to them while you're looking them directly in the eye. And if you remember speaking to your own parents, sometimes it was really intimidating when they were looking you straight in the eye and talking about these challenging topics. So try to do it while you're doing an activity in parallel. For example, if you're walking with them or you're driving them, or as I sometimes do with my own boys, when it's late at night and it's dark in their room and they're perhaps already in bed, and then I come in and I start chatting with them and they're not really looking me in the eye anymore and they're just a little bit more relaxed. So my other tip, of course, is to think about doing it when you're not directly looking them in the eye. And my final quick tip is that sometimes we as parents, and I'm certainly guilty of this, is that we tend to go on and we forget that our kids and teen brains are developing until sometime through the early 20s. And so they may not be able to completely connect all of the information that we are sometimes actually explaining. So less is more. And in fact, the recommendation that I have and certainly talk about in the book is sticking to what's called the 50% rule. So try to say half of all of what you are hoping to say, because sometimes making it very simple may be an easier way to have that connection and to have that effective conversation with your teenager.
Now, what do we have a teenager, you know, sometimes we see, you know, mood swings and things like that and can chalk it up to being a teenager and no big deal. How do we know, though, when where the line is between normal teenage stuff and a problem that we really need to look into and maybe even seek help for?
Right. And you know, that's tough. And certainly part of adolescence and part of being a teenager is actually sometimes feeling at one moment very happy, but the other moment very kind of sad. You know, there's certainly a lot of up and downs in terms of mood, partly because of brain development and all of the hormonal changes that are going on. But if you're noticing that your teenager is seeming to kind of go in and out of those moods a lot more than usual, they're even more irritable or prickly than usual. If there's changes in terms of they're sleeping a lot more or a lot less, or their eating habits are really changing. If you had a young person that was mainly connecting with their friends and now they're really not wanting to connect with their friends or do things like extra activities with their friends, that may be a concern. If anyone at all mentions dying or giving away their possessions or not wanting to be around anymore, that definitely is a red flag. So I think that it's really important as parents to be attuned. Sometimes you know your child more than anyone else, being attuned to these little changes that might be going on, but also very specifically asking. And what I talk about in the book is that many times parents are afraid to ask how kids are doing. They're afraid to ask if they're depressed or suicidal. And in fact, what we do know is that if you do ask a teenager, you're more likely to get information and get them the support that they need. So again, asking very specifically if you are concerned is so important to, again, make sure that they get in for counseling or anything else.
Getting back to the global teen concept, you mentioned earlier the challenges, but also the rewards and benefits of, you know, the experiences of being around different cultures or different places and so on.
Yes.
How about for those parents who, you know, they are part of the dominant culture, the kid fits in culturally, but they want to bring some of those benefits in. Do you have thoughts on ways that people can give that kind of exposure to different cultures, even if it isn't just naturally part of their lives?
Absolutely. And I think that's so important to consider right now is how we can, again, open our own children and teenagers' minds to other cultures and experiences. And certainly one way to do that is traveling, which is, of course, a little bit more challenging right now. But post-COVID, I do think that, you know, having young people have that experience of being able to go to other places is really important. But you don't need to really go very far sometimes to be in a community that's very different from you. Sometimes even in your own state, even a couple of miles beyond, you know, you can have that experience of being in a very different community or culture. I also think that the idea of volunteering in other communities is also very beneficial for young people. Being able to attend events or activities or cultural organizations that are talking about other cultures, the idea of taking on another language is really important. It's certainly something that I would certainly encourage young people to consider is, of course, having more than one language and holding on to that language as another way to learn about other cultures. So these are just some of the ideas. Certainly there's other ways in terms of, you know, food and trying different foods, being open to other families of other backgrounds and trying to understand where they're coming from are other ways, again, to learn what's out there. But I certainly think this is so important right now that we are able to be open to these other experiences and what other cultures have to offer.
Dr. Abraham, just a minute left. Can you leave us a little bit of, I guess, parenting encouragement for getting through this COVID pandemic?
Well, it's, you know, it's a difficult time for everyone. And what I do know, having lived around the world, is that teenagers across the globe are going through the same experience of, again, feeling isolated, feeling anxious and feeling depressed. But I do think that we as parents have a tremendous ability to also build what I call resilience or having bounce, which is this ability to help kids to be able to handle and navigate challenge and disappointment. And in fact, that's one of the biggest predictors of success in life, is the ability to get back up on your feet after you've had a disappointment or challenge and be able to kind of navigate that failure. So I do think that the pandemic is a wonderful opportunity for us to also build that resilience, to certainly have conversations, to really support our kids in so many different ways.
Dr. Abraham, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Anisha Abraham is a pediatrician and adolescent health specialist. She treats and counsels young people with a variety of concerns, including social media use, drug use, and stress. She's the author of the book, Raising Global Teens, a practical handbook for parenting in the 21st century. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. tomorrow at 8. Kate welcomes the author of the book, We Gather Together, for a look at the cultural traditions and the science between harvest season celebrations. And of course, you can join in with your traditions and your questions for Kate and her guest. That is tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll take a look at the recent call for President-elect Biden to forgive federal student loan debt in whole or in part. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.